Hi, welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are going to look at the legacy of Tron, and I dare say a little bit about the original Tron as well while we're at it, and also the visual effects technique of head replacement here on the VFX show. I'm joined by Matt. How are you, Matt?
Great. Just got back from seeing Tron. And
as I was about to say, yeah, you just literally stepped in the door.
Yeah, I saw it with my son and two of his buddies. So I saw it in the ideal circumstances in 3D with three super excited little kids.
Excellent. I must admit, I saw it with my daughter, and she's just 12, and she's absolutely a Transformers fan. And kind of so, again, I think I saw it with about the right demographic, though. I think three boys is even more on target. And I'm also joined by Ian Fales. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
So, Ian is actually our newest member of staff here at the FX Penthouse, and Ian's joined us this week. Congratulations. Which is last week, wasn't it, Ian? Congratulations.
Thanks very much. Yeah, having
already
a great time.
Had you out on set. It was kind of fun for you.
It was indeed, yeah.
You didn't fall off the cliff, which was good. Always a good thing. this week, we're just going to get straight into the movie. So, Matt, let me start with you. Did your gang of three enjoy the film?
Yes, they did. The two first graders, they thought it was a little bit scary, and there was a little bit of sighing and some, like, ah, every time there was a long dialogue scene, which didn't surprise me. It was pretty funny watching these guys. But, yeah, they all liked it, and I have to say I was surprised. I really liked it, too. I'd been reading some about it, and I didn't try to avoid everything, but I'd been reading bits and pieces about it. I really did enjoy the first film. I saw that when I was a very young man myself, and so I probably had the nostalgic eyes of a, you know, 12-year-old or something when I watched it. I've since watched it again and still find it an enjoyable film to watch, and also for historical reasons as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie a lot. I walked out of the theater and I made the joke. I said, "The dude abides, Tron," because he was very Jeff Lebowski.
Yes, yes, yes. It was funny, that wasn't it? There was just enough kind of smattering. Now, I should point out that Matt and I are of a generation that actually would remember the original Tron. Ian, you probably weren't even born when Tron first came out, were you?
I think I was 5 years old. So
okay.
I didn't see the original Tron until I was about 14, I think. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed this one. Really, really got into it. Have been hanging out for it for, you know, nearly 2 years, I think, and came away really liking it. I suppose my only comment would be that at the beginning I was kind of waiting and waiting for them to get into the Tron world. And, you know, I guess that was my only issue, that it was a little bit slow at the beginning until you got in there.
Well, Matt, let's just quickly discuss the original Tron that you and I both saw and liked. And that was, look, it's applauded for a breakthrough in computer graphics, and it was great, though there were significant sections that were actually hand-animated. I think one of the really interesting things was the suit look, where everything was basically done by filming it in black and white and then colorizing it later with roto and stuff. At the time, though, it did seem like this was, you know, everyone was sort of like pushing the boundaries of computer graphics. And I think if you'd said, where would we be in 2010, you'd actually imagine we might even be further along than we are. But do you feel like the future is, what did you think of the effects back then, and how do you think that it's advanced since?
Well, the effects back then in the original Tron, you know, there's all kinds of great stories about the making of that movie, and the design of the world, the design of the Sid Mead design of the light cycles, and I mean, I thought it was just brilliant. There's one other film in the same era that I think also was a Disney film, The Last Starfighter, which is very similar in terms of its graphic quality, as well as it's also oddly similar in kind of its hokey, schmaltzy kind of qualities, right? It's a real Disney movie. It's a family film, and I think that's really its intent. And I actually thought this movie holds up in the same way. It really did feel still very much a family movie. But in the original, you know, I remember going to see that in the theater and totally being captivated by it. I think 12. I think it was 82. Is that right when it came out? It was just, I think, going from sixth grade into seventh grade, I believe. And I was totally captivated by it. I thought it was really great. I remember having some Tron toys as a kid and stuff, one of those little light cycles somewhere. And playing, you know, I was playing video games. I would ride my bike down to the arcade and put quarters into a machine and play video games with my friends. And so it was really capturing kind of the zeitgeist of that moment in popular culture. And the computer graphics aspect of it, I knew as a kid that it was something, it certainly looked very different from, say, Star Wars or the other films, you know, and Empire Strikes Back, the other kinds of films that I was really interested in watching at the time, that I was a big fan of. But so I knew it was different, but I don't know at that age that I really, you know, put two and two together and was like, oh, this is computer generated imagery. And, you know, these effects are done in a different way. It was just a total escapist fun.
Yeah, I mean, I was, God, you guys make me feel old. I was actually finishing high school. I hadn't actually left high school when it came up, but I was certainly 17 or 18. And the thing about it is that it was good. It had some stuff that even then I cringed over as a visual effects sort of aficionado, as I was at that ripe young age. And in particular, the end kind of sequence with the main CPU, it struck me as being really kind of not particularly advanced. And I really wanted it to be advanced. I wanted it to be
the MCP,
the definitive. Yeah, I wanted it to be the most incredible piece of computer graphics stuff ever. And there was a terrific Cinefex that came out around that time, obviously covering the issue. But I thought it was amazing. I thought it was great. I thought that there were lots of really interesting aspects about it. I just thought that the computer graphics really hadn't got there yet. The look of it, it was all it was a little bit like well, there's a couple of Disney films around that era. There's like Black Hole was around that era as well. And they just didn't quite deliver to the degree that Star Wars delivered. And I think that was the problem. We were sort of hoping that we'd get a level of realism that was way beyond what was possible for the technology.
It kind of felt like those
then.
Disney films, though, were kind of taking a slightly different path than the path that was taken with the Star Wars films. I don't know that this is actually correct, but when I think about the look and the feel of the original Tron, The Last Starfighter, or even The Black Hole, there's a lot of traditional style effects animation, right, that was done in The Black Hole in particular. That's how all the lasers were done and the sparks and things like that. And a lot of that same kind of work was done in Tron. And I think the tack that they took and the look that they were trying to achieve was something that was – it was really a different aesthetic than what you would see in a Star Wars kind of film, the kind of work that was coming out of ILM at that time. And it just has a very different feeling. I think, you know, I would probably concur that I don't think it's as great, but there's that scene in The Black Hole where they're struck by a flaming meteor and it rolls through this miniature and knocks a bunch of glass apart in the ship and stuff. And, you know, some of those things were very ILM-esque, very Star Wars-esque. But, yeah, they definitely had a different flavor, and I'm not quite sure.
Well, see, the thing for me was that in about August of that year, Star Trek Wrath of Khan, what happened in Australia. And that had the Genesis sequence in it. Now, the Genesis sequence had a level of realism because of the fractal nature of the construction of the planet. And it was like, wow, if that's what you can do in a film who's primarily live action, you know, I expected, like, to go up a notch from Wrath of Khan. Of course, I didn't appreciate when I was, you know, that age, that I was looking at the most advanced computer graphics we'd, you know, made as a civilization in Wrath of Khan. But I sort of imagined that, you know, that was what was going to happen. And then Tron was going to top it and top it big time. And I just didn't feel like I had the Wrath of Khan shot in. Because the Wrath of Khan shot for me was just completely take your breath away. Oh, my God, we're making realistic planets. Now, looking at it today, the pre-moon surface before they get into the mountain construction looks hokey. But, oh, my God, the mountain construction seemed to be a level of realism and high-frequency detail of kind of beyond what we imagined somebody could model. And so I thought, oh, well, Tron is going to be just, you know, that 10 times better kind of thing. So it didn't deliver for me quite because I had unrealistic expectations. I'm totally willing to admit that. But that being said, I also do think that the film got romanticized into being slightly better than it actually was over time. But by the same token, I also think it was really breakthrough and really defined a whole lot of things. And often films, when they break through like that, aren't necessarily huge commercial successes. Tron wasn't nominated for any kind of visual effects Oscars. It was nominated, I think, in costume and something else that year. But it was, you know, it's typically the case you'll come up with a film that's so breakthrough that it sort of isn't going to appeal to a wide audience, and there you go. And I think that Tron, therefore, had a cultural significance that probably outweighed its cinematic sort of values, and that's fine. I think that's good. I think this one probably has, therefore, coming into it, got a weight of expectation that is not dissimilar to what I had between Wrath of Khan and when I first saw Tron. This one was going to be the most amazing thing ever, because we all romanticize the original Tron as being, you know, mind-numbingly great. Whereas I think this film is just a good film with some brilliant visual effects. But when people sort of say, "Oh, it's a bit disappointed in the plot or whatever," I'm like, "Really? What did you expect?
Yeah, it's Tron. Really? Come on."
It's Tron, and it's a Disney film. I mean, really? You're really expecting, you know, War and Peace? So I don't think this was ever going to be a subtly nuanced piece of storytelling like we saw in a, I don't know, Lord of the Rings kind of thing, which came from a much more literary kind of background. I think it was like a fun film that had some brilliant visual effects. And so that's my take on it anyway. Let's move to those visual effects now. And discuss them. And I guess there are probably two areas to discuss. There's everything that isn't the face replacement, and then there's the face replacement. So, Matt, where would you like to start?
Well, I'll start off the face replacement. I would just say, you know, this movie visually, I thought it was just absolutely beautiful to watch. I really enjoyed the sort of the conceit and the design of the world. I thought it was really cinematically, it was just really fun to watch. The 3D, I found to be, you know, on par with some of the better 3D, although I think, as I've stated before, I'm not a huge 3D fanatic, but I really did enjoy, the design, the look of everything in the film. It was definitely, there were a couple things, I thought a couple missed opportunities that would have been really fun. They had a great flashback scene in the film where they flashback to the young Jeff Bridges circa 1982 with Tron and Clue cruising around the world. And I thought it would have been a great opportunity for them to maybe play a little bit on the history of the films and do something where they maybe made the flashback look a little bit more like the original Tron. I thought that would have been kind of neat. Overall, I thought just visually, the design implementation, the kind of the taking of some of the original Sid Mead designs and the art direction, I thought was really great. You know, definitely there were things in it that were, you know, a little silly, I suppose. But, I mean, you have to take that leap with a film like this where you're willing to sort of have the suspension of disbelief and say, all right, this is Tron. I'm going on my Tron ride now and kind of go with it. But yeah.
Well, I guess, Ian, what did you think?
Oh, I definitely agree. I think, you know, there's so much to look out for in this. There's so much detail. And once you're in that Tron world, I found it really captivating. And I sort of agree about the 3D as well. I wasn't really distracted by it. I thought it was used well. And, you know, they could have gone really over the top considering there's flying discs being thrown at you and those light cycles and everything. So, I want to see it again just to see some of the detail in the crowds and that Tron world.
Well, and it was also really, in the same way that you were describing the original Tron, Mike, that it was shot in black and white, this had a real monochromatic look to it as well, the way in which they basically colored everything in the world that wasn't Clue or his bad boys, you know, that were kind of red or orange. Everything else was very austere, very clean, and at times almost looked black and white as well. And I think that added a lot to the original feel of it, it felt like a really unique and original visual style.
Yeah, look, I thought it was... I thought that the style was great. I think Digital Domain needs an enormous amount of praise for this film, because this is a film where they really totally crossed the divide between post-production and pre-production. The film is unusual in that it went to Comic-Con three times in a row. And DJ was involved from the outset at making the initial kind of pitch videos almost that then turned into the, you know, sort of teaser videos, which turned into the film videos. And so their role right throughout the whole filmmaking process from the very earliest stages through, of course, all of the VFX we're going to discuss. And I want to be really clear about this because we're going to discuss the visual effects, but to contain Digital Domain's sphere of influence to just the visual effects and be doing them a gross disservice. We're probably going to discuss that visual effects, obviously, more than anything else because it's the VFX show, but you should know that it's just a massive undertaking in design, in styling, in lighting, that really, I think, just places, I mean, it's amongst Digital Domain's, you know, finest work. So that being said, in terms of the visual effects, there's just one little tiny bitch. Can I have this before we get into it? Which is that, did anybody else miss the fact that the bikes could suddenly just ride around like bikes and didn't have to do right angle turns? Like in the original, yeah. I loved that. Like in the original, it was that it broke the laws of physics and it just did an instant right angle turn. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, of course it could in the computer game. Plus, computers tended to do that, right? They were very bad at sort of natural, realistic things. So that was the only complaint I had. In a homage to the original, they should have had those bikes just doing the right angle turns and not doing the whole just it's a Ducati race on souped up weird bikes. That's my only complaint.
Yeah, I mean, that stuck out to me too. It was one of those things where when you saw that in the Comic-Con trailer that kind of circulated around a couple years ago now, but where they were moving in a much free form, which, yeah, definitely is a departure from the original. But at the same time, too, I don't know. I actually thought the look of that and the more kind of free form aspect of it. I mean, I guess that's the thing I think is interesting about this movie is I think there are specific to the effects. I mean, I thought the effect of the wall itself coming off the back of the bike, it kind of looked almost like a bubble. You know, the texture coming off the back was really beautiful. The way they did that look, I really thought that looked nice. But I also was thinking too that you know, there were some interesting opportunities that I think were missed in the script that was put together. I think they could have gone a little bit further into some of the sort of aspects of digital technology, where digital technology was and where digital technology is now. They didn't really explore.
It was almost as if the only nod to the fact they were in a computer. Well, put it this way, Ian, like, I'll challenge you this. Name me what the differences were between them being on an alien world in the future and in a computer. And I would say there are only two that I could pick. One is that when they cut people, they depixelated. And I'll hold off what the second one is for a second.
I'm not sure, but I guess they could go a bit more 3D, couldn't they? They could go in different levels, but that might not be what you're thinking of.
But do you know what I mean? Like if you were to say this was a film on an alien planet, yeah, then it had, and I told you that's where it was set, and I just showed you a bunch of clips, you'd buy that, right? I was going to say the only other thing that is obvious is the trails from the bikes, which is like forms this wall that sort of, you know, would otherwise seem quite computer. But everything else, like throwing the discs, the fights, apart from the depixelization, it all just felt like we're on an alien planet. Hey, we're going to hitch a ride on a Star Cruiser thingy, which was obviously a freight train analogy. I think you said that actually, a freight train. But the thing about when they jump on it is it's going in a kind of a non-symmetrical, you know, it just was like in a straight line going somewhere. It wasn't as if that couldn't have been some built in some physical world. And I just felt like in the original one, there were real laws in that world that meant they were inside a computer. Right. In this. And it wasn't helped by, as much as I love Daft Punk DJing behind those visors in the club, and as much as I thought Michael Sheen was awesome as Zeus, that, you know, again, just gave it the feeling that we were in another alien world and we'd just gone to the cantina of that world and any second Han would shoot first. Do you know what I mean? Like, that just didn't feel so okay. But I'm over that now. I'm going to move on. Oh, and by the way, I just think Olivia Wilde did a terrific job. I thought she just her performance was really, really good, far more than just the token woman. But anyway, okay, so let's talk about the visual effects stuff. And we've already discussed the world a bit, but very dense world, very large. interesting, a lot of volumetrics, which of course weren't in the first film because we just really couldn't do them back then. So a lot of the bikes were kicking up dirt, kicking up dust, kicking up kind of vapor trails. And the whole world seemed to be much more misty and mystical than it was in the first for me. Was that the case for you, Ian?
Yeah, that's right. There was just so much more going on, wasn't there? More to look at. And I really liked those scenes of the disintegration in the Dis Wars. You know, I thought they were brilliant. And, you know, you hadn't really seen that kind of stuff before. So that was really cool. And, yeah, I liked the sort of watery look of that wall, like the sort of fluid kind of look. I guess they had the opportunity to do more with it, considering the technology has been improved. But they still kept it in that Tron look, so I really like that.
I mean, the film had a large budget, rumoured to be... Do you know what it was, Matt? Rumoured to be like a couple of $100 million.
Yeah,
it was like astonishingly large budget.
Sure, yeah.
And it's been marketed really, really heavily, so there's like a lot of money in addition to that. But by the same token, I know some people that worked on it and, you know, like not talking about the main visual effects supervisors and stuff, and that the sense going around the industry was that Disney was trying to do it right. They weren't trying to cut corners. They weren't trying to, you know, do stupid deadlines. They weren't hacking and making just gratuitous wastes of money kind of decisions. And I thought that it looked like a big budget film, very, very, you know, much the case. It had just a depth of its shots that just screamed production value.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, just having seen it, I had a hell of a good time. Like, it was a really fun movie. Is it a great movie? Is it a really serious, you know, epic film with like all kinds of subtext and undertone? No, you know, it's not. Like, it can't be. It's Tron, right? But I think, and yeah, did they break any really new ground in visual effects? And I gotta say, I kind of don't think. My answer to that would be no, unless there's something.
Get the fuck out of here!
Unless
really?
There's
you don't
that,
think that?
Unless there's something I don't know.
Hello. Really? Yeah. Clue didn't no,
I,
strike you as being
say,
advancing
think,
the art?
I don't know. I mean, I think the Benjamin Button was better. You know, I think they did it better.
All right. Well, let's discuss that. As much as I'd like to discuss Michael Sheen's pinball wizard impersonation of Elton John, the face replacement wasn't just a shot or two like we saw perhaps in Terminator 4 with the reconstructed Arnold Schwarzenegger. This was a real character in the film that had to have a bunch of performances. Ian, what did you think of Clue as, and I'm now referring to the character, not the old programming language from the first one?
Well, I mean, overall, I think he was absolutely convincing. And, you know, if you didn't know all the techniques that were used to make him, I think you would come away being really convinced. Occasionally, just occasionally, there were some soft shots, you know, where you were sort of looking and you're thinking, maybe it's not quite right. But I just think overall there was just that same convincing result that you got from Benjamin Button.
Matt, not
well,
so?
I guess, I mean, you know, I would say in the there's one scene where he gives a Clue gives a speech in the I guess he's inside of the big giant. It's not the Recognizer, but the big ship where he's got his army amassed. And there's a
the Nazi,
the Nuremberg rally or whatever, right? And and when he gives that speech, that was the most animated that I saw the face in the face replacement, where I was like, oh, it's really working there. And there were definitely maybe a half a dozen other shots where I thought it worked pretty well, but I did feel like, you know, it ventured into this kind of uncanny valley, the classic uncanny valley territory, especially sort of above, like nose up on the face, the subtleties of the kinds of expressiveness that we saw in, now I know they weren't human characters, but in the character faces in Avatar, the level of detail movement in the eyes, in the forehead, the subtle twitches in the eyebrows and the eyelids, and the quick, sudden movements of the eyes, it felt as if they hadn't captured that same kind of performance from the rig they used on Jeff Bridges, and they didn't.
No, I disagree with you on that one. I actually reckon that the face in this was better, more realistic, and less gamey than the faces in Avatar.
Okay.
I respectfully.
Yeah, yeah, no, no, sure. I mean, I, it's one of those things that's funny. I mean, I was watching it really closely and trying to, and I think in a few shots, I really did feel like it worked, but I guess I don't know, maybe it was also the intent. I don't know in terms of the performance that they captured from Jeff Bridges. I don't know what the actual performance looked like, but I just felt like some of the time, you know, he has such an expressive face, the actor does, and I felt like a lot of the time the Clue character, I think it when it was not moving, I mean, it looked fantastic, you know, when he wasn't speaking, right? I think he looked amazing. I mean, that I will grant you, but I thought that some of the actual performative motion, the animation, the subtle sort of secondary, almost subconscious animation that you'd expect to see in some of the smaller facial muscles and stuff, I didn't see enough of that for me.
I think I'd agree that it was a little bit of a toned down performance, and that he was meant to be giving, I think it was intended that he was meant to be giving a measured sort of look, and he didn't move his head around wildly, and even in perhaps the fight sequence at the end with the older Jeff Bridges, it still was quite measured. But I don't know. The problem is that we probably know too much about how it was done,
right?
And I think if you didn't know that, you'd come away pretty convinced.
I think that's a really good point too. Like if you went into the film and you didn't know, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm just like nitpicking it, right? I'm, you know, pixel effing it or whatever, as we used to say, right? Like I'm really nickel and diming it to death, and that's probably not fair. Like I think if you went into this film and you had no idea that that was a digital face replacement, you're like, oh my God, how did they make Jeff Bridges look so young again? You know, then I think you're totally right. And so, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Well, let's geek out as to how they did that for a second, and then we can come back to more reviewing it. So there's a couple of things that I think advance the art here, and I'll tell you why. Firstly, if we look at the, and I think there's a trilogy of films here to be discussed. The first is Benjamin Button, as you already mentioned, but the second is The Social Network, and obviously this would be the third. In The Social Network, you were matching a face side by side with the same face, obviously meant to be a twin, but, you know, it was the same lighting conditions, same everything else. You had the exact reference of that face in that lighting setup, albeit a foot to the left. So that was interesting, but I mean, it was really something you could nail, right? Like that highlight, his skin doesn't do that. Look, I can tell you it doesn't, because here he is with his head a foot over there and it's not doing it. If you go back to Benjamin Button, they were taking somebody that we know well and aging them sometimes to very extreme levels, which meant that we're in no position to judge. Is that what he's going to look like when he's older? I don't know. I mean, I think that Brad Pitt may or may not look like the aging of the Benjamin Button. It was certainly believable in the film. It was completely believable in the film. And I bought that lock, stock, and barrel. But in terms of reality, I have no gauge on what an old an old actor is going to look like, because I haven't seen the actor because he hasn't aged. In this was the exact opposite. In this, we absolutely knew what Jeff Bridges kind of looked like. And we had sort of the double-edged sword that we knew what he was going to look like, and they had no reference of what he looked like, because there really was no, exact reference or lighting reference of Jeff Bridges for them to work off. There was only old films that he was in. Now, of course, a film shot in black and white and colored by hand isn't a really good lighting reference for skin textures and stuff. But even if you take him from other films, and we've spoken to the guys from DD for some stories at FX Guide, that the other films, he plays characters. When he plays those characters, he looks distinctly different. Because it's not, you know, one of those characters where, like Arnold Schwarzenegger always basically looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And no disrespect to Arnold Schwarzenegger, but, you know, he's not really a character actor. Mm-hmm. Jeff Bridges did. So I think that you got this really interesting problem for the DD guys. They had to make a younger version of this guy when the audience kind of feels like they know that. And that's got to be completely normal in the same way that the face match in Social Network had to be normal, because, you know, it's a normal age of a face. You can get away with a lot when it's an older face, because, you know, you kind of wrinkles, and whether it is or isn't exactly the older face, it's, you know, kind of a little bit of room to move there. But if we go into the specifics of how they actually did the shot for a second, and I don't want to make this a lecture, but Jeff Bridges walks on set, and it isn't even necessarily a lit set. It's possibly first unit still filming, second unit being the visual effects guys have said, hey, we're going to get on this set. And they would film his performance with witness cameras and four cameras around his neck with dots on his face. And this would be a performance of Jeff Bridges in that space, delivering those lines, interpreting the set that he's walking around in. Totally valid, but as I say, not lit. It's not the hero play. Any cameras that are filming at this point are witness cameras, and they're not like a master camera.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the actor that's going to play Jeff Bridges then is either there or watches that performance back on the witness cameras and tries to mimic Jeff Bridges' body movements as exactly as he can with the actors, and it's that plate with that actor wearing a skull cap that's going to be used for the head replacement that will be the performance that you see in the cinemas. The thing about this that's kind of interesting is obviously they then have a digital version of Jeff Bridges' head. They target track from the old Jeff Bridges' head to the younger Jeff Bridges' head, and then obviously produce a fully digital head that pops on the body of the other actor. That's actually quite a different process from Benjamin Button. Because, man, in Benjamin Button, the actor, being Brad Pitt, wasn't on set, wasn't giving a physical performance, wasn't walking the space. Brad was filmed much later in a studio where he just had a cut-down thing to go with. It's quite a different process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that's why I was sort of making the analogy that it seemed like it was more similar to what they did in Avatar, at least to my understanding, in terms of, you know, capturing with the witness cams the performance on set, and then, although they weren't assigning it to an actual physical body that was actually there. So, yeah, it's sort of a hybridization between that and maybe the Social Network technique, yeah?
Yeah, I guess in Avatar you had the luxury that if you wanted the character to be left or right, you just moved him and his digital head left or right. Mm-hmm. In this one you had to put the head on a body that had the complexity of what that body was doing at that moment as the interpretation of replaying Jeff Bridges.
Well, and that would kind of explain some of it too. Like, I mean, you know, I think that one of the other things that sort of stuck out, aside from, at least to me, aside from the things I mentioned before, was that I did feel a little bit as if it was sort of like the problem in the first Batman film, right? Or some of the Batman films early on where he has the big cowl on his head, right? And so, you know, he's doing all these fighting things, but he can't really turn his head side to side, right? It's like he's wearing like a neck brace or something. And there was sort of a stiffness to the performance of the character. Now, I mean, you could obviously go down the road and say that there's a conceit, you know, that he's a computer program and, you know, and you know, it felt like, you know, one of the references they were watching a lot of was, you know, something like Starman or something, which is, you know, would be a terrible example to watch in that movie. You know, Jeff Bridges gives a really stiff, intentionally stiff performance, right? And I guess I just sort of felt like that was one of the things that I think what they accomplished was amazing and it looked really great, but I still feel like the technology and the ability to really pull it off where it's just indiscernible. I feel like we're just still not quite there, I guess.
I think that I think for me it felt like it was an effects shot in the way that it feels like something can maybe be a comp. Not that I would say it was really bad, and certainly not that I would say I could do a better job. The shots that were weakest for me, and if we're going to get really critical about it, is when Clue walks down the stairs at early in the sequence, his head bounces left to right. I don't know if you remember this shot, but it's really early on in the film. I don't think we've even met old Jeff Bridges yet in the grid. And I felt there the head was possibly mathematically tracking, but the only thing I could interpret from that is that the head would have a certain physics to it if it was bobbing, and maybe the bobs that you get from the actual actor giving the body performance didn't kind of match the facial something. So that was one that I felt like it just felt like the head was not detached. It wasn't like a bad track, but it certainly didn't feel like it was performance head totally matching the body. And the other one for me was when Jeff Bridges makes Clue and they have him either side of the divide. And that was the one I think you were referring to, Ian, when you said it was like a bit sort of soft or glowy or something.
It just felt to me like occasionally there was like a filter that you were looking through to see his face. And I don't know whether that was really an effects problem or something else about the projection.
But I think, God, like if you took that technology, I mean, maybe, Matt, what you're saying is you don't think you could make a young Jeff Bridges feature film of him at a diner in the 50s, or sorry, whatever it was, the 80s, where it's just a narrative film and you'd get away with it. Is that what you're kind of saying? Like, you think it's almost there?
I feel like, yeah, I guess that's the thing, is I feel like it looked great, and I feel like it's so close, but I do feel like there's still something that is not quite working in total, where where at least to me, where it feels believable, and whatever that thing is, I think it's an ephemeral thing. You know, I mean, I think it's difficult to put your finger on it specifically. And the kinds of things that I mention are the only kinds of things that really stick out in my head: the stiffness of the movement of the body, or what I felt was sort of the stiffness in the upper half of the face. Like he was less expressive, and I think that, you know, those kinds of things I think are possible, but I don't know. I guess I don't know enough to know if there was an intent to keep the performance subdued in some ways. So it's hard to say specifically. I think you're right. Yeah, a 1950s film in a diner where he's some, you know, really convivial, you know, kind of lively scene or something. This character wouldn't pass muster in that regard.
I think I agree with you, Matt. I think they nailed the look of him and his skin texture and the digital hair, I think, works really well. But maybe the performance is the thing that distracted you or others as well, because there's been a bit of critique around about that look of Clue. But generally, I mean, if you look at the skin and the pores and, as I said, the digital hair, I just thought it worked. It just looked so good.
It's having a problem, isn't it? Because old Jeff Bridges gives a really good performance. I mean, he actually acts in this. For an action film, kind of kids, whatever you want to call it, he's contemplative, thoughtful. There's stuff going on beneath the surface.
Well, it's just, again, I mean, I just love that guy. I mean, that guy is such a great actor. Like, everything I've seen him in, I can't think of a movie I've seen him in that I didn't like him in. I mean, he's just, like, he's one of the best actors working today. I just think he's a fantastic actor.
What was the Academy Award thing that he did?
Crazy Heart.
Crazy Heart. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And I can't wait to see True Grit for the same reason.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So let's discuss some of the other visual effects then. The suits. A lot's been made about the fact that the suits were practical suits and they cost, I don't know, $60,000 each or something. And I would say to that, great, that makes for good publicity. But did anyone really think that those suits were primarily practical on-set illumination, that they weren't augmented by a team of incredibly nice guys sitting around at somewhere in Santa Monica, having just walked over the road from the Rose Cafe and thinking about going around to
a firehouse
for lunch? I mean, you know, really, come on. Like, that was a lot of augmentation. I don't care. I mean, probably it was great to have a $60,000 suit to get some of that illumination on the faces, but there's no way that those suits were all going to be ever, I think. I think it makes a good PR to say that was like a lot of stuff was done in camera and all the sets were made as much as possible, but I think that's just to diffuse the fact that people think that they're not going to like it if it's digital, because I think there's no doubt that they were great suits, but that was just so done in post, don't you think, Ian?
Oh, I think so. I think you can tell. I quite like the scene where the suit's put on the young boy by the girls.
And it girls, in inverted commas, yes.
And it grows on him. I mean, I think that's...
The sirens?
I think that looks pretty good.
Nice little flash on his eyeball, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah. You know, my favourite effect, just as we were talking about the other effects in the film, was the way that the vehicles came into being from that little stick. You know, the light cycles turning into light cycles and the planes at the end.
Okay, that was something that could only happen in a computer. I'll give you that one.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think that was one of those killer trailer type effects. And, you know, for so long, the scene of that plane turning into a plane was the last shot in the trailers over the last 2 years. And I just almost cheered when I saw that on the screen.
Well, and it harkens back too to the original Tron and the way in which the light cycles are generated in the first film. And I do think, that was the thing in the where they run and they jump. And I love the way they shot it in this film, where our hero character, what's his name, Sam. He runs and jumps sort of full frame in slow motion. And that was that was really great. Mm. You see the entire vehicle coming together almost in a wireframe at the beginning, right? And then, you know, going through the steps of
that was articulation. A shot, yeah.
Yeah. Really, really great looking stuff.
Because you mentioned the trail of the light cycles, that kind of fluid Sims look in the trails. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the matte paintings, just the matte paintings. When I say matte paintings, obviously it's in stereo, so they must have been virtual environments. But that was pretty impressive. I mean, and by the way, I'm teasing a bit about those suits because I know that Christine Clark, whoever it is that designed them, is going to come after me with an axe when she doesn't win the Oscar for best costume. Nevertheless, I thought the environments themselves, like the complexity, the shapes, the architecture and stuff, it worked really well, and they were really good. I was poking around the scene visually, just looking at details. I mean, it had to be pretty epic. There was no reason for it not to be epic, and I think it delivered.
Well, I think that's what I was saying, too, so much so about the just the overall concept design, the design aesthetic of everything. It was so all-encompassing, and it felt like it had a really cohesive design aesthetic throughout. There wasn't anything that came about over the course of the narrative in the world that felt like it didn't belong, right? I think it had a consistency to it that, especially in a film like this where everything is being designed, and I think there's oftentimes a propensity for something to really stick out like a sore thumb, and I felt like this was really well handled in that regard. Everything really did tie together.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there was a consistency to design. I didn't have a problem with the, you know, blue light, red light thing because the audience, especially kids, could kind of get lost as to who the good guys were and who the bad were, especially in some of those plane sequences. It was, I know, a little heavy-handed to have, you know, black and white hat kind of stuff, but what do you think, Ian?
Yeah, yeah. And also just what the point that I was waiting for in the film was to get blown away, and you do when he first enters that world and he's traveling on these crazy ships. You're just marveling at that world, and I think something can be said about the music at this point too, because it was doing the job of taking you away. And I think I just loved a later scene where there's this huge bass sounds that Daft Punk are doing. I just loved that. That was probably one of the best bits, actually, in music for me.
Matt, did you go to the director's presentation at SIGGRAPH this year?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you remember when he was talking about the fact that he felt like he was interviewed by Daft Punk to, or that they were auditioning him to see if he was going to do justice to the film before they did sort of even talk about
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, the soundtrack was really great, and the I agree with you, Ian, that low register, that kind of that sort of almost overmodulating, although it's not quite overmodulating, it's like just a really low registering kind of buzz and hum that you got both in the music but also in some of the sound design too, like the thrusters that were the effect for the thrusters coming out of the bottom of the the recognizers or whatever when they would pass by screen. That was some of the stuff I remember from SIGGRAPH being the audio from that. It was one of the first shots, I think, in that SIGGRAPH reel that was really in the Tron world, and it was really loud and had that same kind of effect in the audience there. And it definitely adds so much to the image.
Yeah. Actually, one of our producers has just sent me a note pointing out that the director, Joseph Kosinski, how do you pronounce it?
Kosinski.
Yeah, apparently is slated to direct the remake of The Black Hole.
Yeah, I've read that, yeah.
Which is pretty funny as we were referencing it.
Yeah, well, it's perfect, right? I mean, I think, if anybody's interested, he actually, the director, has a great website. It's literally josephkosinski.com, and on there you can see, because he'd never made a feature film before, which I think is really interesting that he was given sort of the reins of such a huge tentpole picture for Disney, having never made a feature film. But if you go to his website, you can look at a lot of his commercial work that he's done, and he's done a lot of video game cinematics and video game commercials. And I felt like looking at his reel, you can kind of get a sense as to why the studio had confidence in his ability to pull this off. And I do think, you know, like I was saying, I mean, while this is not a, you know, really an actor's movie per se, it's certainly a visionary's movie, you know, and I think he really did bring a pretty powerful vision, stylistically at least, to the screen.
And as part of the same note, I was pointed out that Popular Mechanics actually has a story on the light suit and the electroluminescence flat light rigid stuff that was done into elastopolymer-based poly-light suit latex design. Sorry, Photoshop designed foam latex built self-powered suits, which I'm sure is good press. But as I said, I'm all for the VFX guys.
You say that ten times fast.
Ignore Popular Mechanics there, but we'll put a link in the notes somewhere. Anything else in the visual effects realm that you just, I mean, would you have a shot at sort of naming, Ian, say, your best favourite kind of the most? I guess you've already said it when you first entered the...
Apart from when the planes and the light cycles form into being, I also cheered, as did half the audience, with the opening Disney castle logo in Tron 3D.
My daughter actually said, God, that's cool. with the laser scanning and stuff, yeah.
And just to continue that, I thought the opening titles were quite effective too as it turned into the real city. I thought that was a good intro to the film.
Yeah, I thought that Disney thing was excellent. I love it when someone gets to play with stuff like that. Of course, by the same token, you'd think that was, playing with the crown jewels, wouldn't you? I mean, I was great, but I mean, it was like, wow, getting to do that with the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
Would have been some animator's dream come true. What about you in terms of fave shots, man?
I mean, I think the two sequences, you know, I actually wish there was one more sort of set piece sequence in the film. There were the two sequences of the bike race and then the light jets, you know. I was kind of wanting one more. But the other stuff that I really thought was great too was the de-resing effect and the. And I did like the two times that Jeff Bridges used his sort of Neo powers. I thought that was kind of cool. And that was one of those things. There were so many things where I kept waiting for sort of little homages to the original film to come out, and they didn't. And I have to say there were a lot of there were just a lot of missed opportunities in this movie in terms of, you know, a kid who saw this at the age of 12. There were things I kept expecting to see. There were sort of the petrified bits that he had on his mantelpiece or something that Clue comes in and picks one up at one point. Because in the original film, there were these bits that fly around, and they would say they were, you know, binary, right? So they would say yes and no. You know, and there were things like that they left out of this film that I thought would have been fun to see. And I thought there were some great opportunities to do some interesting bits, either with, you know, Jeff Bridges' character and some of his abilities as sort of like the super user, the creator or whatever. And they played with it a little bit, but it didn't go far. And I did hear a few people before I saw this articulating that they felt like this was really I don't want to put words in his mouth, but they were saying they felt like this was sort of, it felt as if it was a precursor to what Disney maybe will want to do in terms of making it a serial, right? We had Tron in the movie, the actual character Tron, the program Tron, who is called Rensler or something throughout the film, and he's like a bad guy. And towards the end of the movie,
he goes blue.
He goes blue and when he falls in the water, but it sort of felt really unmotivated. I was sort of like, well, wait, what? What's going on here? What happened? And then you also had Cillian Murphy, who is a great actor in his own right from some of the, right? I played Scarecrow in the Batman movies, and he's been in tons of other films. And he was at the beginning as the son of the Dillinger character from the first film, but he's only in the movie for like, you know, 2 minutes. Mm. 2 minutes. And I'm like, well, what's that all about, right? And so I felt like they were sort of setting us up for, you know, whatever Tron 3 or whatever, somewhere down the road.
Or a prequel.
Yeah, or maybe a prequel.
The shots I liked from a just kick-ass kind of point of view is I liked the shot where is it Tron? I think it's Tron at this point. I don't know who it is. Strides out to compete, and there's a low shot. It's in the trailer. It's in the film, and the character is striding out in the stadium-esque environment, taking these big pacing steps, helmet down, to fight. And I've got to say, as he's doing that, you know, obviously heading up to fight Sam, it's just a really good camera move, a really solid shot.
You got those binary fireworks kind of in the back.
Fireworks, yeah.
It's just like a, you know, bring it on kind of moment. That, and I think jumping, the slow motion shot where he jumps to form the bike, Sam jumps to form the bike. I agree with those. Yeah. They're really, really great. From a technical point of view, though, I'd have to say in Sam's bedroom as a young kid, I think they were shots that people could be really proud of, because you would no longer had the addition of flash and bam and you know, lighting and weird suits and stuff. You just had a father talking to a son, and maybe one shot from outside the window where Flynn steps behind the pillar so you don't see his face felt slightly contrived to me. I was like, well, if I was doing this shot for real and I had the actor, was there any reason why I'd hide his face? We know it's his father. There's no plot point for that. It just felt like they were not revealing his face, but almost not revealing his face because we all knew it was a visual effect, in which case you've just taken me out of the film.
Well, and that shot in the bedroom too, where he's sitting on the bed talking to him when he's a young boy, was really, the cinematography there was really, it was just really smart too, in that it was really essentially backlit, right? He just had kind of like a rim light on the front side of his face and a little bit of fill on the other side, and the rest of it was in shadow. And that really helped a lot with, you know, the overall effect. It helped sell it.
Everyone should be back three quarter.
I mean, yeah, right.
Back three quarter is the only way to go. But didn't you think that would be like, if you had that shot, you'd be really proud of that
absolutely.
Shot as a VFX artist. And yeah, look, if you're going to have statistics, I'm sure that shot doesn't take the cake compared to these massive shots at the end with the environments and the huge particle systems of shooting up in the air and the discs and, you know, a bazillion drones coming to kill you. And I understand that they were very good shots technically, but I don't know, just for sheer kind of elegant sort of visual effects serving the plot, having the father in the bedroom with the young Sam, I thought was just really good. And you know, it isn't obviously the kick-ass shot. It just happens to be a shot I thought was or a sequence that was really nicely handled and terribly important, because you know, in days gone by, we'd have played that whole thing out with never seeing the father's face, just hearing his voice off, because we all, as an audience, would have known we couldn't have seen his face because he didn't exist. I don't know if anyone found out about this, but did they treat Jeff Bridges' voice to make it sound younger? I mean,
not sure.
It was Jeff Bridges' voice.
Yeah, I mean, I actually was thinking that they hadn't. I don't. If it turns out they did, I'd be surprised, because I was thinking that they hadn't done it, and I actually thought that he, as he's aged, his voice, I think, and the way in which he speaks has become, it's become more gravelly, you know, he kind of, that anyone's voice changes a little bit as they age. And I felt like that was actually one of the other things that stuck out, was that not always, sometimes he really had the dude kind of voice, like, come on, man, you know, that kind of sound going on through his voice. And that, you know, was fun because it's Jeff Bridges. But at the same time, too, there was at times a real kind of gravelly quality that to me sounded like an older man's voice than what you would expect to hear from sort of the younger iteration of Jeff Bridges. So I'd be curious to find out if they had done anything like that. But I'd be surprised if they did.
He's also playing the older Jeff Bridges as a person who's into mediation, you know, and Zen, mm-hmm, isn't he? Mm-hmm. So he could perform that character perhaps differently than the younger Clue, and it was a clear distinction.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I you know, I just forgave Olivia Wilde for leaving House when I saw her in this movie. I'm going to stop talking about Olivia now. So... Oh, really?
She was good.
Cute haircut.
Yeah, yeah.
So do we want to just do a bit of a technical sort of roundup on the film, just for those that are paying attention at home? So it was shot on the F-35 mm-hmm. Stereo rig. Now, those F-35s are not small, so that's a pretty friggin' big rig. It's primarily a 1920x1080 kind of capture, but shooting digitally anything but... Sorry, shooting stereo anything but digitally would be insane. And the F-35 is certainly, you know, up until, I think about the time this was done, it was definitely state-of-the-art in terms of cameras. Interestingly, though, a bigger sensor and a shallower depth of field than you'd get from shooting with the earlier camera, because the 23 has a, obviously from the name, 2/3 inch sensor, and that's what, say, Avatar was shot on. Mm-hmm. So you get a bigger depth of field, smaller sensor means bigger depth of field, more things in focus. I personally liked the shallow depth of field in this film, which is why I mention it. And I'd be interested in your guys' opinion on this, because, you know, theory says we shouldn't have a shallow depth of field in a stereo film. What do you think, Ian?
Well, I think It's interesting because there's two worlds to look at, aren't there? There's the world that's in Tron, and obviously that's all in 3D, and that's very clean, and I think I really did notice what you were talking about, but I'm not sure what they use for just the outside, the real world scenes, and I kind of felt they were a bit soft sometimes, so I'm assuming they didn't use the same rig for those because it wasn't in 3D.
I would have thought they would use the same camera, though. But what do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things. That was actually something we didn't discuss at all, but I thought it was interesting at the top of the film how they had a little thing that went across the screen that said, you know, this film is shot in this particular way and that the first part of the film is in 2D and then the rest of the film is in 3D, right? And they made a specific thing about telling you that this is what you're going to see, and that was sort of a conceit, right, of the design aesthetic that they were sort of going for overall. And, you know, the please put your glasses on now. And I took my glasses off a couple times during the 2D sequence just to see, and you could tell.
Me too, yeah.
It was really interesting to look and see that, you know, it was noticeably brighter, right? They had everything kicked up in terms of the brightness because you're losing, what, a stop or two or something, I guess, when you put those glasses on.
Not two, but yeah.
And
it would have been dumb to have a big put your 3D glasses on now super flash.
Exactly, totally. I actually was curious, so did either of you guys see it in IMAX or?
I didn't. I saw it in digital, but not in IMAX.
Yeah.
No.
Though the IMAX actually had a different aspect ratio. It was 1.44 versus 2.35.
Right, yeah.
Very interesting aspect ratio. Not what normally happens where you just, you know, maybe blank the top and the bottom of the screen for the IMAX screening, which I thought was interesting.
We did see the IMAX 23-minute presentation, actually, and that was pretty crisp and clear too. But
was that an IMAX we saw that?
Yeah.
Oh, it was, wasn't it? Yeah, we saw 23 minutes of it in IMAX. I forgot about that,
So does that mean when they were shooting everything, are they shooting framing for that 1.44 aspect ratio? Or
well, they're getting 16x9 out of the cameras. They're getting 16x9 out of the cameras. So they were, cropping down in for the version that you would have seen in non-IMAX.
I see. Interesting.
Now, there's something else I wanted to ask you guys about. Have anyone seen Tangled yet?
No, not yet.
No.
So what they do in Tangled, which I think is really interesting, is that, two things. Firstly, they have a floating window in front in almost every shot. So for those of you that aren't familiar with the technique, the concern you have with 3D film, not so much top and bottom, but mainly left and right, is if I've got a person standing on the side of frame, and let's just use their head, for example, though no DOP would probably frame it this way, and their head was cut off by the vertical on the right side of frame, and yet the stereoscopic effect was to have the head in front of the screen, your brain gets upset because you know the head's forward by the stereo effect, but you can see this line of the screen where it's obviously sitting behind the line of the screen, and much in the same way an Escher painting can upset you. Mm-hmm. You know, your brain says, well, that's back. Oh, wait, it's forward. Wait, it's back. And, you know, normally that means people say, oh, well, just try not to break too much on the edge of frame on camera, right or left. And the bottom we can kind of live with. Well, the trick about this is to actually have a fake rectangle that sits in front of the thing that's sitting in front. And so what tends to happen, therefore, is that your brain says, oh, that's okay. The edge of the screen is actually sitting out in front of that guy's head, even though the way they've achieved that is by producing a fake edge of the screen. And, of course, it's just a black rectangle, but anyway, a fake edge of the screen. And that sort of solves things. And that was used I heard a lecture from the Tangled Disney stereographer in almost every shot of Tangled. Hmm. And not only can they do it just as a rectangle brought in front of the 3D, but they can do it so that it's not parallel to the screen plane. So, for example, it might, on this case we're just describing, might be forward on the right but back on the left, or it could be tilted so it's out at the bottom and not at the top. And that's a pretty interesting trick for selling the audience. And you might just say, well, why have stuff sitting out in front of the screen? Why not just have everything behind the viewing plane? Isn't that how we normally discuss these things, you know, cool modern 3D films, try not to have things popping out in front. Why don't we just have everything behind the screen? But the problem is you limit yourself in the amount of sort of stereo real estate you can use, because if you think about it, if you had everything starting at the screen and then going back from there, you don't have a lot of volumization that you can do because you've already said, I'm not going to volumize anything between me and the screen. So you're kind of cutting off your leg despite your face because you can't get anything having lots of volume because you can't bring it forward. You're limiting yourself from doing that. And the only reason you're limiting yourself from bringing things forward is because of this screen edge problem. And so they kind of regain some real estate by sort of pretending like the screen is actually more into the studio than not. Now, That's one thing. The second thing is that they split shots and they have a rig, a Disney rig for their computer animation team that'll actually produce a stereo effect on a foreground element, a completely separate stereo solution for the background, and they just comp them together. And so your brain reads it as a coherent stereo picture, but in fact, it's an impossible shot. It's like having a impossible depth of field shot where you've got something close to camera in focus and in the distance in focus.
But if they're doing it that way where they're comping it together, do they both then have to have – they would have to have different convergence points, right? Like that.
Yeah, completely different.
But you couldn't do it where the convergence point of the background was closer than the foreground, could you?
Not closer, but what happens is you would get a massive stereo offset at the background
right.
if somebody had their head close to camera. So let's say you've got a shot of Clue and you've got him nose to camera pretty much, you know, he's delivering a hero piece of dialogue. And then way behind him, his henchmen are standing around and a couple of cool, you know, architectural things. Well, the things in the background would left, right, separate a lot, so much so to get volume on Clue in the foreground that you'd be really annoyed if you tried looking in the background. It would kind of be a head bender. But if you've shot people on green screen, or if for that matter, you can just separate them in post, you can actually just have a sensible image in the back that you would have if there was no Clue in the foreground. You completely separately render a version of Clue in the foreground with nice separation. You just composite the two together, and voila, you've got a consistent feel and mathematically inconsistent foreground and background. And I was really keen to see with you guys, because for the life of me, I couldn't pick the floating screen in this, but I did think they had some stereo tricks, because we weren't getting what I was expecting to be problems in the background for those close-up headshots. But the trouble is, you have to look away from the face that's close to camera to kind of pick it. And I didn't see it happening, so they must have been doing dual rigs. I just didn't know. I haven't read anything about that. I haven't seen anything about that.
Yeah, I actually thought, you know, overall, the totality of the 3D, it didn't feel that – it's funny. It felt more heavy-handed when I saw that – whatever, that eight-minute bit that they showed at Seagraph. But at least at this theater, I don't know, maybe it was where I was sitting in the – it didn't feel that 3D really overall, the whole movie. I mean, which is
a good thing, right? It's a good thing to come away not feeling that.
Yeah.
And they probably could have, because they could have gone over the top, because you think about the disc wars, those discs coming straight at you, but you never felt like that was done as a
super
corny,
good.
Crazy effect. You know?
See, the thing is, if you lump Pixar in with Disney, and I don't think you necessarily can, because they're actually quite different technologies in one sense, but if you take Disney, and we're going back now to Chicken Little kind of frame, yeah, Disney, I think, as a studio, is just nailed 3D. And Bolt and obviously the Pixar stuff is just superb, as we discussed when we were discussing Up. Though, as I say, I think they're slightly – in fact, the rig I'm talking about, the digital rig from is something that Disney handed to Pixar when the companies did stuff. But they are different setups. Disney tends to produce separate elements and then comp them together. Disney is doing that because it can. It's completely valid. Pixar, on the other hand, as you might expect when you had an infinite number of render licenses, tends to just render the picture as like a solution. And obviously, if you're doing the solution approach, you don't do what I just described, which is split foreground and background so much.
Right.
But I would say Disney is one of the best companies in the world right now for just managing a stereo project. I take nothing away from DD, but you know what I mean? Like that, there's a master level of control coming from Disney with real science and some astonishingly good stereography that makes it feel, you know, like I'm not kind of noticing it so much. Don't you think? I mean, I didn't fault the 3D on this, and I'm pretty fussy with 3D. I kind of hate it half the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why, I mean, I really felt like at times I almost feel like I didn't notice it. I mean, I was conscious of the fact that I'm sitting there with glasses watching a 3D movie, but it was spot on. I mean, I think, and it really did. You know, I know that people talk about the conversion technology for converting something that was shot 2D to 3D is getting better, and they're getting better at doing that. But I really do think they're. I mean, for my money, at least, seeing this, knowing that it was shot stereo, I mean, it's such a difference. I mean, it really. There's no potential headache. There's no, you know, confusion as to what's where. Like, I mean, it just felt really solid.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think I thought that. I think if DD is the place to go for head replacements, and clearly it is, because, I mean, there's just no doubt that these guys are insanely good. I just wanted to flag the fact that I think Disney, as a studio, has got their stereo under control so well. Now, Prime Focus, I know, is in the credit list for companies that worked on this film, and I don't know what capacity they are, but obviously Prime Focus is the people you're referring to when you're talking about dimensionalizing, because Narnia and things like that were dimensionalized, and dimensionalized very well, so I don't know what role Prime had in all this. And
well, they actually did a couple of the visual effects of that container ship heading out towards, you know, in that end sequence, and a couple of the other environments, yeah. So more of a visual effects type
They
role.
Didn't do stereo?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just to round out the effects companies then. So Quantum created the incredibly great suit that I'm going to retract every comment that I've ever made about that was awesome, that was powered by 7 lithium batteries. No. Quantum did make the special suits. Prime Focus, you said, did some of the freight train stuff, yeah?
That's right.
And then Mr. X, what did Mr. X do, you know?
I think they did some of the environments in the real world, right. But also, you know, some other matte paintings.
And then Digital Domain obviously nailed it. I mean, it was a Digital Domain film, and as I said, this was not a case of Digital Domain coming in and providing VFX-type support. This was Digital Domain as a film partner in developing the product and developing the world. And we really can't emphasize that enough. This is a kind of a big departure from, you know, that idea of a hired gun on a film. I've no idea what the financial back end is, none whatsoever. I'm not intimating anything there. But I'm just simply saying that I know that they were on it for not just, you know, weeks and months, but years, and had very, very significant roles to play in developing a ton of this stuff up. Is there anything else that we wanted to flag before you go? I think we've covered the stereo stuff. I think the only other thing I was going to mention is I believe the Codex Digital guys provided a bunch of Codex recording stuff, because I don't know exactly how it happened, but obviously the F-35s would maybe record to an HD cam, and I think they might have gone to disc with the Codex system instead of going to that. And also there were some really good camera rigs on this film. Obviously, time for another show, but yeah, some really good, because there were some substantial sets built. They're obviously extended, augmented, etc., mm-hmm. but there was quite a substantial thing built. Is there anything else you wanted, Matt, to just to flag before we moved on?
You know, not off the top of my head. I mean, I think, you know, this was a movie I was really excited to go see. I'd been sort of anticipating this probably with a lot of our listeners for a number of years, really eagerly looking forward to see this. And I've read a number of the reviews that people have posted, and I would concur with just about most of what I've read, although I think the people who go to this movie and walk out and say, oh, it was terrible, I was really disappointed, I think they are going to it with a sort of a crazy expectation. I think going to see a movie called Tron, if you've seen the original movie Tron, you know, you've got to have a certain you sort of have to know what you're in for. But I think that what they put together for this film, while I do think there were some missed opportunities, I think overall the visual effects were really, really great, really stellar work by all the houses involved. I mean, I think if this was something that, as an artist, if you worked on this film, you'd have some really great stuff that you could put on your reel and feel really proud of.
Yeah, and I've been poking fun all this show about the $13 million wardrobe budget for this film. But the only reason I was doing that is because, quite frankly, I do think that if you were an artist that actually worked on the electronic suits and then read on an IMDb or whatever, that there was no need for any post-production work on those suits, you'd be a bit mortified. So there you go. And I think the last that I wanted to throw out there is I believe filming took about 64 days and post took about 68 weeks.
Yep.
So just gives you some idea as to the massive contribution from the great team at DD. And you've got to be feeling pretty good about DD right now. Like, this is again, another great film where they were the principal house and really defined and controlled it in a way that that you get from having that, you know, lovely cooperative and I guess kind of collaborative thing that, you know.
Oh, just that they were involved so early on, you know, in the concepts and in the previews, and it's not really a visual effects role anymore. It's a production role.
Plus they had the Eurythmics in it.
Yeah, right. Sorry. Sweet dreams as he walks down the hallway. Yeah, well, and I think too, you know, DD, I know over the better part of the last, I want to say 5 years or so, they've had some new folks too in the senior management. Mark Miller, who I used to work with way back when, he's been, I believe, the general manager at DD for a number of years now, and he comes with a huge amount of experience, and I think he's done a lot to really help DD, along with all, of course, the supervisors and all the artists that work there. But I think it's really exciting to see what they're doing now and the kinds of work that they're putting out and at the level at which they're achieving. I mean, they're one of the major houses, but I think that, you know, for a long time, I didn't hear as much about DD, and it seems like lately they're working on all the big...
There was the dark years.
Yeah, well, when the company was sort of in flux and the original founders were selling bits and pieces off, right? But yeah, I think they've really come back.
You'd have to say some of that selling off worked out really well. Like Nuke has done remarkably well since they sold it off. It was a good move all around. I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
Good for any Nuke artist that's using it. So look, let's change the scheme. Let's alter the mood. Let's electrify the boys and girls and acknowledge this is our last show for the year. So we want to say Merry Christmas to everybody, and hope everyone's travels safe around the Christmas period. Matt, where are you going to be spending your Christmas? Presumably somewhere cold.
Yes, it's quite cold here. I'm going to be up in northern Virginia, sort of near the Washington, D.C. area for Christmas, and then hanging out here for New Year's. And tonight we have a lunar eclipse at 1 o'clock that I'm setting up my time lapse to film.
I was talking to the guys at Off Hollywood who have got the new Epic camera, and they're going out to the moon.
Well, that's going to look better than mine, but...
Lusty. And if people wanted to wish you Merry Christmas, where would they be best to try and stalk you?
You guys can always find me on my website at mattwallen.com or on the Twitters at Matt Wallen.
And Ian, where will you be spending Christmas? Presumably a warm or even hot Christmas.
Yeah, just be sticking around sunny Sydney, watching lots of cricket. Not sure that everyone around the world knows.
I think actually you're now working for us. You're not having a holiday. You're just going to keep riding all over. No, I'm just joking. But if people want to follow you, obviously you're writing for FX Guide now full time, which is terrific. We applaud that. But also you do have a separate Twitter feed.
Yeah, it's at VFX Blog. That's where you can find me on the Twitters.
Excellent. And of course you'll find me at FX Guide, and as you know, I'm always there at fxguy.com, but I'm on the Twitters as Mike Seymour. So if you look at Mike Seymour, that's where I tend to post a bunch of stuff and do a bunch of stuff. There's also, like, if you guys want to send us any info or whatever else, please do. There's a separate email account for VFX Show, but there's also just a general one called podcast@fxguide.com. Just podcast@fxguide.com. Now, we get quite a lot of email from people suggesting shows. In fact, people were complaining we hadn't done a traditional Tron show. But we'd love to hear from you. I mean, we really would. And we get a real buzz out of hearing from people that talk and listen to the show and obviously work in the industry. And at various times, we've had extraordinary emails from people over the VFX show. People that have said, look, we were working on the show and we really enjoyed listening and we didn't think you'd notice this thing or whatever. So whatever it is, whether you worked on the show, you just want to hear some particular film brought out of the archives, or you're looking forward to seeing something coming up, please let us know at podcast@fxguide.com. I want to thank Todd and Matt, our producers, because honestly, I think I said last week, they just wouldn't be a show without them. They're just terrific at not only wrangling us, but wrangling me in particular, much to everybody's horror. So Todd Shelton and Matt Graham, and look, thank you so much for being with us this year. We really do appreciate your loyalty, and the show, as I said, is going really, really well. So we are going to be coming back with a vengeance next year. I pretty much imagine you'll find me sitting here at work when you come back, and you'll say, hey, kiddo, lost track of time. It's back after Christmas. See you guys. Bye.